Welcome back to episode 109 of the Chaos Ball Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, midweek pod. My schedule kind of all over the place compared to last season, where I did have a pretty solid cadence of podcast releases last year. Part of that is the start of the season, and there's just less that I care to talk about in the real nitty-gritty of Mariners baseball week to week, or this early on in the season. But also, you know, life is a thing. But I had some time midweek, and I had some things jotted down that I didn't talk about last week, so I want to talk about the team. I want to talk about the broader game of baseball for a couple things I want to fix and change. These loosely relate to the Mariners, and then honestly, I'm going to talk about Julio at the end of this episode to cap it off, because I can't resist. I know I said last week, I'm not going to dig into the stats until May, because you need a good sample to really jump to conclusions. But Julio is a player that myself and everyone else in this fandom puts under a microscope, more so than any other player on this team. And for a good reason. Julio should be the most valuable player on this team every year. He should be the best player on offense and the best player defensively. He should just be the best player that's not a pitcher on this team, and the most valuable by WAR, at least, to this team's winning and losing. And, you know, he started off with one of the weirder Aprils that I've seen, and not a traditional slow start from him. It's been like simultaneously an encouraging start and another bad start that we've been accustomed to watching him have. So I'm going to dig into a little bit of his stats, and partially is because when I do that episode, there's going to be so much for me to talk about and so many numbers and players to focus on. I didn't want Julio taking up like half of it, because I have a habit of doing that when I talk about him, because of just how much I appreciate him and how much he frustrates the hell out of me, and I'm sure you as well, on a nightly basis. So I'm going to talk about him a little bit at the end of this episode, and if any of those numbers and stuff that I talk about demonstrably change by the time I record my like April stat review, then sure, I will focus more heavily on him, but I want to do it today because I'm going to have the time. But I'm just going to jump into it. How can baseball improve? This first thing I have on the docket comes because of the Masters. I wrote this down after watching the last hour of the Masters, which is what I do every year. I don't really watch golf. I appreciate golf as a sport, but I don't watch it. I watch Masters, and it's almost exclusively on Sunday. In the last, you know, hour or two, especially if it's close. And that was a fun ending to the Masters. A playoff in golf is electric. It's one of the best, like, playoff sudden-death formats in sports, especially at Augusta. It just looks amazing, and obviously is historical and means the most to the game of golf to put on that green jacket. But watching that was fun. It was it was a playoff. That was sick. We watched that. We've seen a playoff in that before recently with someone I'm forgetting his name of who won it a few years ago. But that reminded me that baseball doesn't have game 163s anymore, and I think that's a problem. Baseball needs to bring back game 163s. Tiebreakers are lame. Like, they're just stupid. Like, based on head-to-head record or runs scored or however deep you get in the tiebreaker, determining who makes the playoffs, if two teams end up with the same exact win percentage after 162 games playing baseball from March until October, you send one of those teams home based on some statistics. I love stats. I love analytics in baseball. But God, it's so lame to determine who goes to the playoffs based on like a head-to-head win or like runs scored, like I said. Game 163s, we deserve them. How would you do it in an event of like a three-team tie? I have no idea. how you would do that with a three-team tie. I think we just have to figure that one out. But head-to-head game 163s are just where it's at. If they're not going to give us a one-game wild card, which I'm in favor of making it three games for a wild card. I'm not in favor of it being three teams that make the wild card. I think it should be two teams that make the wild card. I think they should play a three-game set to see who plays the number one seed. And you just eliminate the third wild card spot altogether. That's my take. But if there's a tiebreaker that we need, playoff, one game. In baseball, it's so much more. One game playoffs in baseball of team sports are so much more electric than every other sport. NFL is always one game. NBA, you know, when it comes down to a game seven, that's super fun, I think. But a one-game format in baseball gives you an opportunity to see something you never see again. Or, like you see sparingly. A team using, like, they go, depending on who their pitchers are, like, every pitcher is available to pitch. You might see a team's 1, 2, 3 starters all pitch in the same game in a one-game tiebreaker 163 situation. That's something you might literally never see again. A walk-off home run in game 163? Like, come on. We just need to bring that back. I can't believe they got rid of it. And I need to think about what to do in the event of a three-team tie. See, that I'd be more okay with leaving a team out based on, like, runs scored or whatever. Like, you can choose something and then have two of the teams play. Or how would you do it? Now I'm just talking through it because I didn't even think about this. Send me DMs, text me, email me. Email's in the description of this show. How would you handle a three-team situation? Four teams is pretty obvious. I think you would literally just do a quickie little tournament, maybe a doubleheader. You go to one location. No, four teams. Yeah, you'd have to do random head-to-head matchups. And then whoever wins those games plays to make the playoffs. And you just extend the playoffs out a day to give them space to do that. But three teams, I don't know. Let me know. Let me know if you have an idea. Moving on to another thing, I think. I have no power to get rid of this. It's just something. These next two things are something that just don't really hit with me anymore like they used to. And the first thing is the Nick Castellanos home run gag. I think it's time. I think it's time to just get rid of this. I can't determine that. I don't think it's going to. I don't like what it's become. I think it's run its course. Frankly, we've strayed way too far from the original point of the joke. And if you know what the original point of the joke is, I think if you listen to this podcast, you're enough of a sicko and not a casual to know. But I think it's broken into casual fandom. But the original joke, the inception of this Castellanos home run joke, was it was Tom Brennerman, announcer for the Reds, giving his apology for saying a slur on the air, you know. Famous, maybe the best clip in the history of the sport, and Castellanos interrupting him by hitting a dinger, and Brennerman didn't have to do this, but he decided, you know, to call the home run in the middle of his apology. And then he did this another time not too long afterwards, interrupting a more serious moment on a broadcast. I think it was like a broadcaster like eulogizing a former player or manager or someone that just died, and Castellanos hit a home run in the middle of that. Again, the fact that happened twice, tremendous content. Amazing to joke about that. But since then, and it's been years, this has been years now, it has morphed into if Nick Castellanos' home was within like a 24-hour period of something bad happening, then it's an opportunity for a bunch of people on the internet to make a joke about it. And it's just simply lost its luster for me, like entirely. I'm thinking this now because the Pope just died, which RIP Papa Francesco, Pope Francis. But I saw a bunch of jokes that day. of people throwing like a bunch of money down on Nick Castellanos plus whatever the hell it was for him to hit a home run that day. It didn't happen, which I think is why the joke should die with Pope Francis, who knows, maybe he was a baseball fan. I think it should die along with the Pope, and we should have an MLB conclave for a new joke, or just not joke about that at all, because it's not as fun. It's not as fun to, I think it happened when the Queen died, he homered the next day. Like, it's just not as fun to me. The whole point is he interrupts something. The whole point is he is interrupting something with a home run. It's not like something bad happens 14 hours later, Nick Castellanos hits a home run. Ha ha ha. Am I being lame for this? I just don't think it's funny anymore. That's my take on Castellanos. And moving on. Next one. I'm going down the line here. I got one, I got two, and then I have one way longer thing to chat about that I think could help baseball discourse. But this next thing I think we might have to get rid of, or at least have a conversation about it, does relate to the Seattle Mariners. It's the trident. I'm not talking about the trident in general, like the branding. I think the trident logo goes crazy, and it's like whoever came up with that originally for the Mariners went dummy with thinking of branding, because all-time logo, it looks phenomenal just on any of their retro stuff. And even the newer, more modern look trident is tremendous. Like whoever came up with that, I think it was the 80s, they started rolling out the blue star with the trident coming through it. That logo, their logo in the 80s was sweet. They transitioned to like the M's in the middle of the baseball, which I also think looks cool. Not as cool as the trident, but you know. No, I'm talking about the trident home run celebration in the clubhouse. It just, I feel like players aren't as into it anymore. I feel like the home run celebration fad got old a little quickly. Like a lot of them were fun initially. A lot of them were really mailing it in initially and weren't fun off rip. But the trident was. The trident was cool. That they got an actual, like a legit trident was sick. But it just doesn't hit for me anymore. I think we've started to reach a point of diminishing returns unless they start doing something with it, I guess. Like, should they start throwing it at something in the dugout? Like, should they have a target in the dugout and they try to hit the target with the trident? Ooh, that would be instead of a first pitch, they have giving a fan a trident to throw is probably a huge liability problem, come to think of it. Also, this is a big send me ideas episode via Twitter DM or my email, or if you know me personally, which is many of you, text me. What do you do with the trident? How do you even get rid of it? They have like trident cups at the games now. How do you get rid of the trident in the dugout? Man, I think they just need to rebrand it or do something different with it, because the photo ops are cool. I think it's just kind of run its course, much like this Castellanos joke, but it didn't take quite as long. I think because it happens all the time. Like a home run trident, no matter how bad you are as a baseball team, you hit a lot of home runs. I mean, the Mariners have been one of the best home running teams this season, but you could be the worst team ever, like the White Sox last year, and they still had a lot of home runs. Like, you're going to use this a lot. It's created a ton of really cool photos and little clips to throw on the internet, which is cool. It served its purpose. When we look back on this kind of era of baseball, we'll be like, oh yeah, that's right. Teams started to do their little fun little clubhouse dinger celebrations. So I don't know, rebrand, do something different with it. I think it just might be time. I'm sounding like a curmudgeon in this episode, but I don't think I'm the only person who doesn't get up for the trident anymore, I'll be honest. Those are the two things I think we should get rid of. I mean, I guess this next one is also, we should kind of get rid of something, but this is a way longer take on my part that I've thought about in sports for quite some time, and I still think there's plenty of thought to go into this. But I like to workshop some ways to make discourse around sports better. And it's never going to be amazing in this modern age. I feel like it's, especially with modern media, I feel like it's gotten worse. Maybe in the NBA context. MLB, I feel like it's pretty good. But I think the topic of money in sports really drags the discourse around players down a lot. And I think, I mean, I wasn't alive way back in the day, but when players were making less, I feel like when there was just less money in general and less voices to talk about it via the internet, it was better to talk about sports. I don't know that for sure, purely anecdotal. But I feel like it'd be kind of sick if we didn't know how much money players made. One of the many things that I love about baseball is that we don't really have to worry about a salary. We don't have to worry about a cap on salaries. Yeah, we got the luxury tax and whatever, but that's like a soft cap and just kind of a pussy cap if you're the majority of owners and ownership groups. But, you know, unlike the NFL and NBA, the other two large sports, I think the NHL is a cap, but I don't really consider that a large sport. Sorry if that's inflammatory to you. And soccer, there's no cap. I mean, the MLS has weird rules, but I'm talking about real soccer and the rest of the world. There's no cap. So the NFL, NBA, they have a cap. Everything has to be somewhat made about money, more or less, because you have a finite amount to give out to build your team, right? And trades always have to revolve around contracts pretty much because that's just how it has to work given the constraints that these teams have to operate in. You don't have to spend up to the cap, but most of the teams trying to win do spend up to the cap. Baseball does kind of have the money talk in trades and signings and stuff. Like, there are ceilings that teams set on themselves. There's budgets they set. There's like matching contracts and trades here and there with like matching money, but it doesn't make trades illegal. Like the NBA, there's a lot of trades that literally can't happen because of the money being made between players. MLB, you can trade whoever the hell you want. Like, the contracts don't really matter in terms of the pure like legality of making a trade. So there's theoretically just no limit to the amount of money that you can take on as a baseball team. But money in baseball, and this is true in other sports, but this is a baseball podcast, after all, so in a baseball context, I think the money has just made it so much worse to talk about the sport in general and talk about certain players. When a guy signs a large contract, they are then reduced to that sum of money when folks talk about them online. This is not everyone, but this is, you know, painting with a broad brush here. This is a lot of people. We still talk about guys on the field stuff and off the field stuff that they do, but a lot of times they're reduced to that number. Not every time, but most of the time, that total sum of the contract for baseball, especially, I feel like, because we focus on like the 10 years for $300 million. We focus on the years plus total rather than the per year value. The total sum of that contract, when that's referenced when a guy is struggling often, it's like always something people point to. It's like, oh, he signed this blank money contract and just struck out four times in one game. I just hate it. This wonderful sport, this beautiful sport of baseball, again, doesn't have a salary cap. I care about the players on my favorite baseball team. I do not care about how much money they're really getting paid because we don't have to squeeze all these contracts under a cap. We simply do not have to do that. I don't really care about the supposed opportunity cost of signing a player for a lot of money and how maybe if your team spread that money around to multiple players instead of one, they might be a better team. That's real NBA and NFL pilled of you to think that. Or instead of signing a superstar in the NBA, you sign like one star and a role player or two. And maybe your team might be better. That might be true. If you find yourself as a baseball fan thinking about the opportunity cost of money spent on players after your team signs like a really good player to a large contract, or even just a good player to a lot of money, if you think about the opportunity cost of money in that moment, to critique the deal. The owners have poisoned your brain. Opportunity cost of money does not exist in baseball. The owners can always spend more money. It is literally not illegal to continue to spend money on the on-field product. You have eaten up the ownership propaganda if you think that about these deals, especially with your favorite teams. This offseason, for example, I propose that the Mariners should have just signed Pete Alonso or Alex Bregman to a large sum of money, because it would have helped their team win baseball games in the near future, which is still true. And I still think they should have done that. And maybe you could, everyone's always saying, oh, overpay. There's no overpays in baseball. You can just keep spending money. But, you know, when I say we should sign Pete Alonso or Alex Bregman to a lot of money, even though maybe it's overpaying them, quote, overpaying, that would, like, no, that'd be their entire offseason budget. You can't do that. They need to fill multiple positions, and they can't spend the whole budget on one position, they said. If you also think this, you are shilling for the mega rich. You are disturbingly susceptible to their propaganda. This baseball team, the Seattle Mariners, could have afforded to sign both Pete Alonso and Alex Bregman to both of the deals they ended up signing this offseason, and they probably still could have brought back Polanco, and afforded all of the arbitration increases that they had to pay, and probably still extended Cal Raleigh. It was a conscious choice for them not to do so. I've not fully fleshed out this idea of not letting the public know how much money players' contracts are worth. It comes with its own set of problems. Like, knowing player payrolls and having an idea of how much money a team spends on the product on the field does help hold teams accountable in a certain way for a lack of investment in that product. But I don't really think the owners care a whole lot about complaints like that, especially from fans. Like, I don't really think they care about that, like, at all. That's what I think would be, like, the main problem with that. Of keeping player total monies, like, secret, not publicly known. It would be the kind of transparency for how much the team is spending, not necessarily the transparency of how much the guy's making. I mean, it's the same thing, but different ways to look at it. That, I think, is the main problem, which I agree. That's kind of a problem here. But let's think about this. What if we did this and then also just made baseball teams, they had to be public with their finances? I don't want to get into all of this, but I also think every team should be like the Packers and not have a sole owner or a sole oligarchy of owners, but should be owned by the fans themselves. A lot of European football teams do this. You should look up Bundesliga clubs. They have this, like, 49, or is it like the 50, the 49-51 rule? It's like no one entity can own more than 49% of the team. It has to be majority owned by the fans. I think every MLB team should be like that, but that's all I'm talking about here. I could go on for that, go on and on. But you eliminate the knowledge of specific players' contracts, but baseball teams are required to report how much, like, profit or loss they made in a given year and what their total payroll is. So we'd still know how much they're paying for this collection of players that they have, but we don't know the specific breakdowns per player. Again, I still think that comes with its own set of challenges, but imagine how much better, and let's use the Mariners as an example, imagine how much better the discourse around Julio Rodriguez would be if all we knew about his contract was the length of the extension and when the opt-outs were. Like, the discourse around him just sucks. So much, especially those people that, like, take the amount of money and take issue with him being happy or smiling or laughing on the baseball field when he's struggling at the plate. Happened a lot last season. I've already seen it happen this year, and it's April 24th, 20, whenever you're listening to this. It always devolves into, like, oh, he's hitting 190 to start the year, but he's smiling while making a play, or he's laughing, chatting up Ellie De La Cruz when he's at second base. Julio, the guy who signed a $400 million extension, he needs to be serious out there and be angry and focus on hitting the baseball before being allowed to laugh. When I say that, we all know the type of person who says this and what their Twitter photo might look like. But just, I need to flesh out this idea more. But the idea of not knowing how much players make in total, wouldn't you agree that it might make how we talk about these guys a little bit better? When it would improve how we talk about them. Please let me know. Again, let me know if you think this would actually help how we talk about players. Because I think boiling a guy down to how much his total contract is worth versus validly criticizing things on the field, like there's a lot of valid criticisms for Julio on the field. But him smiling, getting paid a lot of money, or signing a big deal and laughing on the field and smiling even though he's not hitting well is not a valid criticism of him at all. The discourse around players like that, it just sucks, man. I hate it. I don't know how to fix it. I'm just thinking here. I'm not against these guys getting paid a lot of money. That's also not where this is coming from. Like, I think it's ridiculous to get paid that much to play sports or to do anything. But they, and these player contracts and the players getting paid a lot, that is a symptom of a much larger issue. Like, I'm much happier with $400 million going into Julio's pockets than in our ownership group's pockets. So that's always my take on players getting paid this much. Like, yeah, I think Soto getting $250 million is far too much money for baseball. It is far too much money for anyone to ever make doing anything, in my opinion. But I think it's better, and I like that Juan Soto gets paid that money more than all of that money remaining with Steve Cohen to amass more billions for himself. So that's my take on that. But send me suggestions how to find a solution. I feel like I'm onto something, hiding contracts from the public eye and, you know, seizing the means of production. No, I'm just kidding. But democratizing these teams so that they're like more like public entities that have to report their numbers to the public. I feel like there's something here. Still plenty of problems with it, but there's something here. Now, I mentioned Julio Rodriguez. And I told you I was going to talk about his start at the plate this season, and here I go. It hasn't been amazing. It's been weird. I mentioned, 25 minutes ago, it's very strange. The good at the plate so far for him, his walk rate. His walk rate has nearly doubled this season. And all of this, again, please, mega small sample. He has played 24 games. It's a decent enough sample to glean some info, but it's not, this could change, flip of a switch, snap of my fingers. But walk rate, literally double last year and almost double his career average, 12.4% this year. It was 6.2 last year. His K rate. His K percentage, also the lowest in his career, 23.8% right now. And these stats are also as of April 23rd. So this does not factor in the game that they just played at Fenway on Wednesday, April 23rd. But these stats won't change a whole lot because of that. Those are two good things. Walking more, a lot more. Striking out, almost 2% less. His extra base hits so far this year, he already has 8 of them. It took him until May 25th to get 8 extra base hits last season. Almost a full month for him to get as many as he has so far this year. So that's good. That's a very good thing. Couple doubles, couple triples, couple home runs. Spreading them out. Good. That's about it, really. That's about it. Like, his defense, base running have also been good. I'm talking about at the plate. He looks good too. Just got to mention that. He looks great. Great smile. Great cleats and glove and accessories this season, got to say. But then the bad. I mean, he's slashing 191, 314, 371. Like, that's not good. With a 307 weighted on base average. Woba. Now, his expected batting average is 244. That's more than 50 points higher than his raw batting average. His expected slugging is damn near 100 points more than his raw slugging at 469, and his expected WOBA is 355, almost 50 points higher. And his BABIP right now, batting average on balls in play, 230. So he's still hitting the ball really hard. So his you know, that's a low BABIP for anyone, but if you're not hitting the ball hard, it's going to be lower. For Julio, he's hitting the ball really hard. So his batting average will 100% not stay below the Mendoza line. His career BABIP is around 340. So even if he has a BABIP dip this season for whatever reason, he's still going to end up hitting a lot better average-wise and on-base-wise a little bit than what he is right now. So a lot of regression in the mean coming for that. That alone is a good indicator that there's better things to come and that he's maybe been a little unlucky this season. But there's still plenty of warning signs about his power hitting. And even the BABIP, I mean, you hit enough line drives, your BABIP's going to be better. He's hit a lot of weak fly balls, which really lowers your BABIP, but a lot of hard ground balls, which, you know, still kind of is lower than hitting a hard line drive, but not terrible. But I mentioned he's hit a ton more extra base hits than last season already. Incredibly low bar, just to compare it to last season. While his walk rate has jumped significantly and his K rate has decreased a little bit, 2% is pretty good. If that stays for the whole season, I'd be very happy with that. Especially the walk rate, like that's what we've been asking for. His plate discipline numbers, when you go deeper, are just bad, straight up bad. So he's swinging a little more at pitches in the zone this season compared to his career average, but he's making way less contact in the zone than he has in his career. Right now, he has a 71% zone contact percentage. It was 79% last year. League average is around 82%. He is chasing around the same as usual, which is more than league average. He's always chased more than league average. That's been one of his Achilles heels, maybe the worst one. But the worst number on here right now is he has a 35% whiff percentage. League average is 25%. And historically in his career thus far, he's been around 30%. That whiff combined with the high chase rate is really bad. Like, that is very, very bad. He is also swinging dramatically more at the first pitch to start the year, which is super interesting. I think that goes... he's also swinging at a little bit more pitches in the zone this season and more first pitches, which I think goes in line with the hitting philosophy with the team this year, which is the Edgar, like, we're not necessarily going to have a very big game plan. It's like you get a good pitch to hit in the zone, swing at it. That's kind of been the approach, and hit it up the middle. Like, that's the big thing. It's kind of been working for the team. So that's kind of in line with the team philosophy, I'd say. You know, more first pitch swing. Like, you're going to get a strike on the first pitch a decent amount of time. If it's a good pitch, swing at it. The problem is he's missing a lot. But what's weird, too, is he's swinging at less pitches in the very heart of the plate. This is exemplified in meatball percentage on Baseball Savant, which I love. He's swinging at less pitches in the very middle of the plate, which is so interesting, despite swinging at more pitches in the plate, but less in the very middle of the plate. Odd. So he's simultaneously swinging at more pitches in the zone and making less contact with those pitches, but also not swinging at as many pitches in the very middle of the zone. But he's also walking more and chasing around the same, which means he's generally laying off more pitches. Right? But it does not sound weird to you. It's a very bizarre profile. So the next thing I'll mention, and the next thing you have to kind of look at here if you're doing this on your own, is his batted ball profile. That also paints a bad picture. His barrel percentage is slightly down this year. It's not too out of the ordinary, so I'm not like super concerned here. His hard hit rate, still great. Always has been. He's pulling the ball a little more this season than he did last season. But of those pulled baseballs, a ton more of them are on the ground. A lot of ground balls pulled. He is somehow pulling dramatically less fly balls than his total season last year. But that was kind of the huge talking point for him and what he needed to do last season until September, basically. But the amount of pulled fly balls in September he had didn't make up for the whole season's numbers. So he has like 10% pulled fly balls right now. He sat around 16% the past few years, so 10% is bad. That is not good for a guy who hits the ball so hard. He's hitting the ball on the ground to the pull side so much. And if just some of those are fly balls, like, he can saunter to a dinger. His bat speed and his average exit velocities would translate into just, and can. We've seen it happen. It can translate into like 20 home runs to the pull side and 15 home runs to center and right field. He has the power to do that and the talent to do that. So his peripheral numbers paint a good picture of he's probably been a little unlucky. There is going to be some regression to the mean. He's not going to hit this poorly much longer. But long term, his swing profile so far is somehow worse than it was last season. Same amount of chase, but more swing and miss at pitches in the zone, which is bad. You can swing and miss at pitches out of the zone all you want. That can get really bad, but ultimately, a lot more guys swing and miss at pitches out of the zone. Is that shocking? No. And then when he's making contact, his batted ball data tells us he's hitting the ball as hard as he usually does. Lack of pulled fly balls. Ton of ground balls. So not amazing. Those, and I think that is like what can explain his BABIP and expected batting average here, and even expected slugging to an extent, is he's hitting the ball so hard and he's hitting the ball to the pull side on the ground. And while a lot of those are outs, ground balls, and I've said this before, go for hits in play a lot more than fly balls. Fly balls just transition into home runs, so they're more valuable. But ground balls will give you a higher batting average. So that's like pulling hard ground balls. He's been unlucky on those, and those lead to a high average, which is good for a guy like Julio, who can steal a bunch of bases and run the bases really well. And you pull the ball on the ground down the line, that's an easy double for him if it gets to the infield. But it's the rest of it that's just not good. And you want to see a little bit more pulled fly balls. If he's going to pull the ball on the ground a lot, sure. But he's going to need to do it in the air too. And he's just not doing that. So it's just been a weird start to the season. I think I said it's been a bad but different. A different bad. Like, he gave up contact in the zone for doubling his walk rate. Was it worth it? I'm not sure. We'll see how long this continues. But the whiff is bad, man. The whiff, the fact that his walk rate has gone up, his chase rate has stayed the same, which is still greater than league average, but his whiff rate has gone up a ton. It just means, yeah, he is whiffing on pitches he should be hitting that are in the strike zone. So it's just bad because you can whiff. You can even chase. But you get one of those things you have to improve on. Like, it's such a good example. You look at Aaron Judge. Aaron Judge is the best player on the planet. He's been the best hitter on the planet for half a decade now, basically. He whiffs a good amount. He swings and misses at a lot of pitches. But the difference is most of the time those pitches are out of the zone. And he doesn't chase often. He's very, very good at recognizing pitches. He's very, very good at not swinging at pitches out of the zone. When he does swing at those pitches, he'll miss a good amount of the time. But that doesn't matter because the pitches he hits that are in the zone, because he's making the right swing decisions, he crushes. So really, like, Julio's chase rate has never been good. And I've said this so much, that his chase rate literally, it doesn't necessarily need to improve if he brings down the whiff. But if he doesn't bring down the whiff, then he needs to improve his chase. He can't whiff on pitches in the zone. It's just bad. That's very bad. So it's one of the two has to decrease. And it's just become increasingly easier to pitch to him, because the fact that he can't pull fly balls, like if you pitch him a fastball inside, he has the potential to turn on it and crush it. He's done it a couple times, but he doesn't do it often enough. So a lot of the time, that is a ground ball to your shortstop or third baseman. And then if you want to get him to swing and miss, you just throw a slider away. And he just can't lay that off. He's never seen a slider away that he doesn't think he can send 450 feet into the seats. So now that he's missing on pitches more in the zone, now it's even easier to pitch to him, because you could theoretically challenge him more right now, and he might miss it more than he has in the past. So it's just not great. Just not great. There's going to be some regression to the mean with his raw slash line, but the power is still a concern. There's just a mechanical tweak here, I think, that someone needs to make. It's not going to be me. I'm not a swing expert. I don't know what he needs to tweak. Someone does. But he needs to be receptive to it. Changes need to be made. I don't know. I just don't know. It's just been a bizarre year for him, and I want to talk about it because I don't want to taking too much of the stat-heavy episode with just Julio, so I want to talk about it here. But I'm calling it. Thanks for listening to this episode. Please reach out if you think my ideas that I propose were stupid. I don't care if you reach out to me and call me dumb. You can. I'll take criticism, but also reach out to me if you have things to build on those ideas, because I think there's some potential there. But thank you for listening to this episode. I will be back at some point in the next coming weeks to talk about Mariners baseball and some important stats from the month of April. But of course, have a great rest of your week, and go Mariners.